We are tonight going to continue this study of Nehemiah, and let me see if I can find the laser. Where's this laser button on this? Is this on? That's on and off switch. I guess I'll find it here in a minute. Got it. Okay. All right. Here's where we are in the Bible. I don't have much of this map that you can see, but since this is the beginning of a new semester, as we call them around here, I want us to understand the setting of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And we've already covered the first part of Ezra, and the key person in the first part of Ezra is Zerubbabel. And it probably would help us in finding things in the Bible if this book had two names, Ezra 1 and Ezra 2. I'm not sure exactly what you would name it. In my mind, it's Zerubbabel. The first six chapters, book's about Zerubbabel, because that's when you get to the beginning of the reliving and the retelling of what happened when the Jews came back from Babylonian captivity. Now, the Jews had been in captivity. The southern kingdom had been in captivity for 70 years. There's Babylon there, right in that area. Here's Palestine. That's where the Jews were. Right up in this area is the area called Assyria. The northern kingdom, the 10 northern tribes following the death of Solomon, almost civil war, kingdoms divided, and the northern kingdom was taken captive to Assyria. They never had a good king. God was patient with them for 220 years, and they never had a good king. Never one time did they have a king, maybe 210 years. Never had a good king the whole time they were there. Now, the capital city of that northern kingdom, you got to get this, I mean, it will really help you understand the Bible, is Nineveh. Nineveh. If I say Nineveh, what Bible prophet do you think of? Think of Jonah, do you not? Go to Nineveh. Well, why on earth would you not want to go to Nineveh? Well, because Nineveh is just about ready. Nineveh is about ready to bring their armies down and to destroy Jerusalem, or to destroy the northern kingdom. And so when God told Jonah to go and preach to the Ninevites, he didn't want to go. Why? Well, he doesn't want them to repent. You remember in chapter 4? In chapter 4, after the whole city has repented, he gets angry because God did not destroy Nineveh. He wanted Nineveh to be destroyed. But if you don't associate Nineveh with Assyria, it's not going to make a lot of sense to understand part of the motivation behind what Jonah did. I've often wondered what Jonah looked like physically, having been in the belly of that whale, that great fish, for 3 days. What do you think fish stomach acid would do to your body in 3 days? I find that amazing. How he may have appeared. Now, the Bible, I don't want you to preach this lesson about Jonah, but the New Testament says that Jonah was a sign to the Ninevites. Not just a prophet to the Ninevites. He was a miraculous sign to the Ninevites. Now, there's only two possibilities. One is, and this did happen because those men on board that ship, after they threw Jonah overboard and the sea calmed down, they came back to their home port. They came back to this area, and it's possible that the message had gotten from this area all the way up to Nineveh in that period of time. And so it's possible that it was a sign in that way, that those people had seen the miracle of the sea being calm. The other thing may have been the message that he was thrown overboard, and now, all of a sudden, here he arrives up there. It's remarkable. God told Jonah the same message twice. Go to Nineveh. The first time, he went down and went on a cruise. And the second time, I suspect Jonah hit the ground running, don't you? When that fish vomited him out, I suspect he hit the ground running. And can you imagine what it might physically have looked like? I mean, the whole city repented. And so we've got to understand that's the northern kingdom. Now the southern kingdom, which is the house of David and the lineage of David's, and all of those 19 southern kings, guess where you can find them? In the Begat. That's sort of important, I think, to remember why Matthew chapter 1, Isaac begat, or Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob and Esau, and Jacob begat, you know, Judah and his brethren and all that. And all of a sudden, you got down to Solomon, and right after Solomon, you got Rehoboam and Asa and Jehoshaphat and Jehoram. All of that's just it's the lineage of David, all the way from Abraham all the way down to the birth of Jesus. There's a reason for that, because Jesus had to be the seed of David. That's why chapter 1 verse 1 says, the son of David. First thing affirmed in chapter 1 is, he's the son of David. And so you've got that southern kingdom. And that kingdom exists from about 931 to about 606 B.C. Is that 300 years? About 100 years longer than the northern kingdom. And finally, God said, I've had it up to here. And so the Jews then go to Babylonian captivity. I don't know how well you can see that. I don't know if you can see that scale of miles that's there. Your eyesight is probably a whole lot better than mine. But that little bar that is there is 300, represents 300 miles. You think about if you took that bar and moved that bar, how many times would you have to place that bar to get all the way from Babylon? How many times would you have to place that bar to get over here to Jerusalem? Well, it's for sure it's a whole lot more than two. It's a whole lot closer to three, and that is 900 miles across the desert, across the wasteland almost. And so the way they would travel is they'd go up the Euphrates River and then they would come back down, because the level ground on the shores of the Euphrates River, always having water and supplies of that nature, that's the way they'd transverse in relationship to this. So when Daniel is taken captive to Babylon, how far does he travel? You take that bar and you lay that bar up this way and then up this way and then up this way and down this way and down this way. Is that 1,200? Is that 1,500 miles that he had to travel? How many miles can you travel in a day? You know, you're not Pony Express. I'm sorry, you don't have a horse ever 2 miles to jump on. 30 miles a day is pretty good traveling, is my understanding. If you're traveling 1,500 miles, that's 50 days of traveling, being taken captive. And so whenever you get to the end of the 70 years of captivity, the time has come. And by the way, Babylon falls to the Medes and the Persians. They're over in this area. And the army of the Media and the army of Persia comes in and destroys Babylon overnight. The handwriting on the wall, the city is destroyed. In one night, the walls of that city were 87 feet thick. You know how large 87 feet is? From that projector back there that projects all of these slides all the way to that screen is about 65 feet. The thickness of the walls were there. 350 feet up into the air. And God destroyed that city in one night. What are they doing inside the city? They know the Persian army has surrounded the city. They're very much aware of the fact that the Persian army is there. They've got enough water because the Euphrates River runs right through the middle of Babylon. There are iron gates that come down that keep anybody from scuba divers from getting in almost. I mean, you know, you couldn't get in. No such thing as, well, I guess it'd be a little low tide. You're that close enough to the ocean. But you couldn't get into that city. But they had all that fresh water they wanted. They had inside that city, listen to this, enough food for 20 years. Here's that Syrian army, or pardon me, here's that Persian army, and it surrounds the city. You know, if you're 30 years of age and you've got shiny armor and everything, and you've got good leather on your horses and everything, I mean, you're real wait a minute, have you got enough food for 20 years? By the time they run out of food, these soldiers are going to be 50 years of age. Weapons are going to be rusted. And they're going to be scoundering around trying to find food. So inside the city, they're having a drunken feast. And in that feast, they take the vessels from the temple. When Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem, he took the vessels of the temple and carried them all the way back over to Babylon. And so all of the furnishings of the temple were taken over to Babylon. And so in this drunken feast, they bring out the gold and the silver vessels that were holy vessels used to serve God, used in the service of God in the festivals they had there. And they begin to toast their gods. The army's out there. Forget that army. Our gods have delivered us from the Persians. Handwriting on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Little boy went to Sunday school. And when he got home, his mother said, "What did the preacher preach about?" He said, "I'm not sure. It was something like many, 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 many nickels tickle the parson." Okay? And but it's a language nobody can read. And Daniel, by the power of God, reads those words. You're weighed in the balance. You've been found wanting. And this night, your kingdom's going to fall to the Medes and the Persians. How's that going to happen? Well, we've said it before, but I just marvel. The Persian army diverted the course of the Euphrates River. How would you like to divert the course of the Mississippi River? Now, that's the grandeur of what they did. And they marched up the riverbed and took the city that very night. The first year that Cyrus, the Persian king, is on the throne, which would be days later, within that first year, Cyrus finds out a message from God. That message had been written by Isaiah. Now, where's Isaiah fit in this? Northern kingdom falls in 722 B.C. Isaiah prophesies about 750 B.C., 30 years before the northern kingdom fell, and another 110 years before the southern kingdom fell, plus 70 years in Babylon. In 750 B.C., Isaiah spoke and wrote the name of Cyrus in the Bible and says, "Cyrus will be my servant, and Cyrus will say to the Jews, 'Go back and rebuild the city.'" I mean, this is sort of a part of that sermon, "Can the Bible be trusted?" Called him by name 200 years before he was ever born. And so he says, "God has told me." It's possible that God told him through Daniel. It's possible that the Jews who were there, Daniel, by the way, had figured out the 70 years were up. Book of Daniel. Daniel said, "I'd figured up. We've been over here long enough. It's time for us to go back." In Daniel chapter 9, he says, "We've been over here long enough." And it may be the scribes and the Jews had figured all that out. Some way the message came to Cyrus, and if you saw a book that prophesied 200 years ago that you were going to be born, and this is what God Almighty wants you to do, I think you would pay attention to it. He says, "God has commanded me." And so that decree that comes out of Shushan, I think it's the city that's over in this area, goes worldwide. It goes all the way over into this area, into Asia, in Asia Minor. It goes all the way down into the land of Egypt. It goes to the expanse of the Medes and the Persians' kingdom. And it says, any Jew that wants to can return. And that's where we are in Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. That's the introduction. And I hate to take that much time, but sometimes I think it's just good to hear it again. It's faith building for me to think about those things. I hope it builds your faith. And listen, you need to tell these stories to your grandchildren. You want your grandchildren to believe in the Bible? Sit down, let me show you something. This was written about this man, and 200 years later he was born, and God says this is his name, and he's going to be the one that says, go back and rebuild Jerusalem. That's faith building. Now the time comes, and so the first six chapters of Ezra are the return, not of Ezra, but of Zerubbabel. The largest number of people who come back from Babylon captivity come not during the time of Ezra or Nehemiah. The numbers that come with Ezra and Nehemiah are insignificant compared to the numbers that came with Zerubbabel. And so when Zerubbabel comes back, they've got their lineage. It's important for them to have their lineage. And so they know who they are. And so those early chapters in Ezra, man, it says so many from this family and so many from this family, so many from this family. How on earth would you know that? Somebody would have to count them. You know, who's going back? What family are you from? What's your lineage and everything? And so now, roughly 50,000 Jews come back from Babylonian captivity. That's not many. At one of the feast days in Jerusalem, it was Passover feast, there is a writer that wrote to the Roman official to try to help them see how big the Jewish nation was, and says, during the time of the festival, since one lamb will feed 10 people in a family, and if it's not 10 in that family, you got to invite the neighbors over, had to eat all of that lamb, you know, Passover night. He says this is how many lambs that were slain, and the number would have been 2.5 million people. I don't know if that's accurate or not. That's not a biblical number. That's a secular number, and it's a secular number of a Jew trying to impress the Romans about how important the Jews were. But in the destruction of Jerusalem in Jesus' day, 1.1 million people died, so it'd been 1 million people. 1 million people were roughly estimated, 1 million people, when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the southern kingdom, 1 million of them were scattered. And now they come back, and when they come back, not just the two southern tribes come back, read Ezra carefully, and you'll see that all 12 tribes came back. They're called the remnant in the Old Testament. And when you read about that remnant, those are the ones that are really important. Remnant is just a small number, sort of the leftovers, isn't it? Is Noah a remnant? Yeah. Is Abraham and the faith of Abraham, is that a remnant group? Yeah. Up in the northern kingdom, when Elijah thought he was the only righteous man left in that northern kingdom, God said, Elijah, it's something you don't know. I know there are 7,000. But 7,000 compared to 700,000 or some such number, that's not very many. That's a remnant. Let me tell you something. Had those 50,000 people not come back, Jesus could not have been born in Bethlehem. In the way that he was, God would have worked it out some other way. But we owe our salvation to some people who had lived in a foreign land for 70 years. 70 years ago, what year would that have been? It had been the 60s? Is that 70 years ago? Is it the 50s? Almost the 50s. Imagine somebody in the 50s leaving Cuba and coming to America. And they've been here, and their children's here, and there's grandchildren here. Now you go back to Cuba. You want a 1952 Chevrolet? That's the luxury car down in Havana right now. You wouldn't want to leave. It's only their faith in God that caused them to listen to what the prophets have said. And all of those, many of those Old Testament prophets, that's what they talked about. God, there's going to be a restoration. And when you get back, the Messiah is going to come. And they gave up everything and came back. So when they came back with Zerubbabel, they rebuilt the temple. Now get the order here. They rebuilt the temple. You've got to have that temple, if for no other reason, and maybe the primary reason, has to do with the Day of Atonement. On the 10th day of the 7th month, God remembered their sins, and atonement is different from sanctification or justification. It's different from righteousness. Atonement, the New Testament word propitiation, found twice in the New Testament. Atonement always has to do with stopping the anger of God. When you've mistreated your wife and you take some roses home, that is a day of atonement, hopefully. Sometimes it takes more than roses. Otherwise, you'll ride in the house and she'll make you a bloody sacrifice. I'm not sure if that's a good description or not of that type of thing. I apologize to my British friends, okay? You understand. And so on that day, God remembered their sins, and it has to do with atonement, and it has to do with the anger of God. On that day, I'm going to remember your sins. And on that day, you make an atoning sacrifice, the Day of Atonement. It's been nearly 70 years since there's been an atoning sacrifice made. You think of Daniel over in Babylon, opening the windows and praying back toward Jerusalem. That's where the temple was. That's where God met man. We offer all those sacrifices and praise God with thanksgiving offerings and peace offerings. It's where you dealt with sin. It's not there. And so when they get back, and the thing that comes out of Ezra chapter, those first six chapters of Ezra, is they get back and they rebuild the temple. There's an interval of time, most commentators put about 60 years between Zerubbabel and Ezra. I'm not sure that it was that long. I still struggle to see how, when Ezra comes back and they restore the priesthood and the worship, I'm not sure how they could have had that temple and had temple worship during all of that period of time. I'm also not sure what that temple would have been worth if there's no wall around the city. And when we get to Nehemiah, and they come back and they rebuild the walls around the city, I struggle, and I only know of one other preacher on earth that struggles with this, and it's not David, okay? I just struggle emotionally, psychologically, to say, I don't know how that fits in there. And all this has to do with the list of those kings, to prove that this king puts in the 60 days, you got to go to secular history and everything and rename some of the kings. And so it's immaterial to me. But I do know this. When Ezra comes back, they restore the worship of God. They've got the priesthood. They've got it all back together. And so in Nehemiah chapter 1, Nehemiah asks some of the individuals, chapter 1, some of the individuals who had come back from the captivity and they'd been to Jerusalem. To me, that does not sound like something that happened 70 years ago. Maybe all the commentators are right. I'm just a lone ranger almost on this, but But I say that to try to get you to study. Some of you guys are good with numbers and love fooling around and trying to figure how all that fits in there. Anyway, when Nehemiah comes back, they've got to rebuild the city. And get walls around the city. And so whenever we get to chapter 4, and that's where we're going to start tonight, they come back. Nehemiah's come with the blessings of the people of Persia, the Medes and the Persian. And when he comes back, they are immediately mocked. And there are three names that are given here of those who mocked Nehemiah and those who were there trying to rebuild that city. The city is in ruins. Now, they've been back 70 years, but the streets are so cluttered with the destruction of the rubbish of that city that Nehemiah cannot even go up and down the roads. That's another reason I think maybe Nehemiah came back sooner than the others talk about it. But Nehemiah starts to rebuild the walls, and these people, the people who are there, and there's a name, and remember this name, Sanballat. Sanballat is of the nation that we call the Samaritans. Now, where the Samaritans come from? Well, remember that northern kingdom? Whenever the people of Nineveh, when the Assyrians came and destroyed that northern kingdom, the way they ended that kingdom from being a reality was to intermarry. It's a national. And now you've got all of these Jews, descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they're up there in that northern kingdom. And so what they do, they literally take Jews from the northern kingdom and take them and scatter them all over the world. They were not taken as prisoners. They were just, if I say illegal aliens, I don't know if that describes what I'm trying to think or not. And then they took people from other nations, not necessarily Assyria, but they ruled the world. And so then they brought all of these pagan people up into that northern kingdom. And when you read the book of Ezra, when Bill Jr. taught the last chapter of the book of Ezra, they've intermarried with all of these people that are there, and they've got a real hodgepodge of people that's there. When you get to the New Testament, we learn something about the Samaritan worship, and that is the woman at the well was a Samaritan. The Jews had nothing to do with Samaritans. The woman says, "Our fathers worshiped in this mountain." And that's true, that there was the Mount of Cursing and the Mount of Blessing, that they were adjoining mountains, that whenever the Jews got into the Promised Land for the first time, about half of the tribes went on one of the mountains and the other half went on the other mountains. And those on the one spoke the blessings to the people on the other mountain, and people on the other mountain spoke the curses of God back to them. And so it wasn't just somebody, well, they'd picked a mountain. God had said, when you get into that land, go to those mountains. And so God had said worship. But the temple was not there. God selected the place where the temple would be, and that's Jerusalem. And so the woman at the well said, "Our fathers worshiped in this mountain, and you say Jerusalem is the place to worship." She's a Samaritan. It is really amazing that there were, and this is a few years ago that I read this, there were 400 Samaritans still living in that area. And they have, and I'm talking about, you know, worshiping God, Samaritans, kind of, you know, not, I'm not talking now about ethnicity as nearly as I'm talking about their religious devotion. And the oldest Hebrew manuscript of the first five books of the Old Testament that we have comes from the Samaritans. And so they had that copy of the law up there. They didn't follow it. You know, I mean, idolatry is a major problem. When I say they didn't, almost none of them followed it. And so Jesus comes and says to this woman, the hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will they worship God. And then this verse, for God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in this mountain. That's not what he says. That's a question she'd ask. Which mountain? They that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Now, they did not want Jerusalem to be rebuilt. Why not? Because they are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the Babylonian captivity has wiped out all of the southern kingdom. You're talking about the Babylonian captivity. The Bible said only the poorest of the people. We studied Jeremiah in our Monday night class. And all of the Jews except the poorest of the people were taken to Babylon. There's nothing, when Nebuchadnezzar destroys Jerusalem, there's nothing left there except the poorest of people. And then there's a man who rises up and says, I'll help you overthrow Nebuchadnezzar. And they sort of follow him, and guess what he does? He then makes slaves of them and heads down to Egypt. The handful of Jews that were left and Jeremiah's in that group, by the way, when Nebuchadnezzar comes and destroys the city, Jeremiah is there and he is forced to go down to the land of Egypt. Why? Because, well, the Jewish leader said, I'll help you. And he comes to Jeremiah and says to God, what should I do? And Jeremiah says, stay in this land. And he tells Jeremiah, whatever you tell me to do, I'll do it. Just ask God. And so Jeremiah asked God, and God says, don't go, you stay here in this land, and I will bless you. You stay in this land, and I will bless you, figurative, with a land that flows with milk and honey. That's how you read those closing chapters of Jeremiah. And I don't know how many times I've studied read Jeremiah in my life, but this Monday night study, I just couldn't believe what was over there. How can I have read it that much and not understood the implications of all of that? God says to that little, the poorest people in the land, did not choose the poor people, was Jesus not concerned about poor people? And all of the nobility has been taken over to Babylon. And God says to that little, that small number that's there of the poor people that were there, by the way, the governor says, go out and find you a house to live in. That's how well God was ready to take care of these poor people. Never had houses? Go pick your place where you want your farm. God was going to take care of them. And so when they select a leader, he says, okay, let's go to Babylon, or let's go to Egypt. Now then, when the Medes and the Persians start resetting up Judaism, that's what it amounts to, it will be the end of the influence of the Samaritans over in that land. Politically, they are about to come into second place, because the Samaritans don't have the favor of the Persians. It's Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah. They have the favor of God, and God is blessing them. Now here they come back, and they've already rebuilt the temple, and they've restored temple worship. And now Nehemiah comes to rebuild the walls. We've got to stop these people. We cannot afford to let this happen. And so there is that opposition. And so look at the mockery that they bring about. They're called in my notes feeble Jews. How could they ever fortify the city? Let's see if they can do it in one day. Let's watch them build these walls in one day and then have sacrifice, and let's see them complete it in a day. That's the very words they use. And then they said, how will they rebuild these walls out of burned stones? You know, you can't take old bricks without and build a new wall. I know folks do it, but you understand that's the mockery. And then he says, and if a fox ran up to that wall, it'd knock it over. Mockery, mockery, mockery. And Nehemiah and the response to this, and we've already looked at this, and this is just so we can begin again, hit the ground running next week. They began to pray to God to be just and to bring vengeance. We have got to study more carefully how to pray to God. They said, God, you promised, you promised, you promised. And based on your promises, we have returned. Bring the vengeance of heaven on these men who are opposing us. We have power with God, not because of who we are. The righteous prayer, the prayers of a righteous man avails much, not because he's so righteous and he deserves it, but God has made a promise to righteous people when they pray, I'll listen to you, and your prayers will avail much. Visitors, this church believes in prayer. I think it'd be interesting to make a list of all the things we've prayed about and how many times the very things we've prayed about come about. Now, I want you to think about that. Some of the names that you've turned in and how all of that turned out. It's remarkable in relationship to this. And so prayer is based not on us. It's what your kids did whenever they said, Daddy, you promised you'd do this. They're hitting you in your weakest part, if that makes sense. I've trusted you, Daddy. You promised. So they began to pray, and the enemies become very angry. Well, they build the wall up to half height. I need to put that in there. The enemies become very angry, and they make a conspiracy. And so there's the mention of this prayer again in verse 7 and 8. And so the enemy says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to infiltrate. We're going to send terrorists. And if we can just send some terrorists in there, and when they're trying to rebuild this wall, if they can just stir up some things, this wall will never be built, and we will have the favor and the run of all this land that's over here. It'll be ours. And so Nehemiah, well, they did this 10 times. They said that 10 times. And so the people came to Nehemiah, and Nehemiah says, arm yourself and protect your family and fight for your brethren. What a place to study or to close. Fight for your family. God's trying to destroy our homes. There are troubled homes in this church. Not God's trying to. Satan is trying to destroy homes in this church. You better fight for your family. And they understood it. They're talking about being delivered from these Samaritans whose army is far greater than theirs ever were. We need to understand. Part of being a man, being the head of the house, is to fight for your family. We live in a day and age in which men are looked at as being wimps. Every portrayal of a husband on television today is of a wimpy, ignorant, worthless kind of person. First Saturday of May, Power Up, Men's Day. We're going to bring in five speakers, either four or five speakers, and we invite men from all over southern Florida to come here and to spend 2.5 hours today with preachers from all over this area, bringing their best sermons, and 15 minutes is all you've got. And your charge is to power up these men, these people in this audience, to stand up. And I don't have to tell you mothers to fight for your families. That's all you've done since the day they were born. But God needs a man. God needs a man. Fight for your family. That's a good stopping place. Second bell's rung. Thank you very much.